This is Table for Three, a podcast of the Green Duck Lounge Project. I'm playwright Michelle Tyrene Johnson. In Table for Three, we're talking about Missouri's civil rights history, current activism in the state, and issues raised in the production of the Green Duck Lounge. Today, we'll focus on what it's like to be a Black student and professor on MU's campus and in a Missouri classroom. Joining me at today's table is Dr. Adrienne Clifton. Adrienne is a professor of MU's College of Education with the passion for educating students in ways that lead to success. She turns her research into action through her work with the Columbia After School Program, Granny's House, and the Neighborhood Coalition Worley Street Roundtable. Also with me at the table is Dr. S. David Mitchell. David is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a professor in the MU School of Law. He's also an affiliate member of MU's Black Studies program and recently served as chair of the UM System Task Force on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Thanks, Adrienne and David, for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Both of you are working to change the education experience for students. You're in different levels in different places. I'm going to start with you, Adrienne. What are some of the key things that people just don't get about the experience of Black students on campus, in the classrooms?
I think that one thing that people just don't get is that these are real experiences. These are real lived experiences, and they each student is walking in their own experience, in their own perspective. There's not just one story or one experience, but each student comes in with their own unique perspective and their own real experience that should be validated.
Great. And do you think that they bring their home experience into their campus life and that that influences and informs how they feel about MU?
Oh, absolutely. And some children or students come in here with more in their backpacks, if you will, of experiences, and other students are coming in lacking in the way of cultural responsive understanding. And so the campus is a beautiful place to fill those backpacks with the things that are lacking before students get out there and start really interacting and building relationships and working with in the real world, if you will.
David, you deal with students who are in a little different place when they come to MU. You know, law school, it's already a stressful place. What do you think it's like for students of color, for Black students at law school in terms of adjusting?
I think the adjustment is no different than the adjustment at the undergrad level, to the extent that students come, they may feel alienated, they may feel marginalized, they may feel alone, they may feel isolated. I mean, particularly if you think about the fact that our profession is not populated with a large number of people of color. And on the law school faculty, quite honestly, there are two African-American males. In the 12 years I've been there, there has not been a single African-American woman on the teaching faculty, right? And so when you think about isolation or being alone and students who want to make a connection, it's sometimes very difficult. I think that the most important thing is that law school is stressful. It is rigorous for everybody. I think it's doubly so when you add a student of color, their own personal experiences, and particularly if you add the experiences that have happened in the recent years, right? We had a graduating class who came in, and the first week that they, you know, joined our student body, the events happened in Ferguson, right? So that sort of set the tone for their next 3 years of how to engage on our campus. Right. And then, of course, we had the campus protests also the following year, right? So it wasn't as though they ever got a break from, I think, the burden that we often sort of comes along with being a racial minority in a predominantly white campus.
As someone who graduated from MU Law School in 95, I was always painfully aware of the fact that it's not just me adjusting, which was a little bit easier for me because I came to school as a non-traditional student, although 27 seems so impossibly young right now. But what tips, I'll start with you and then we'll go to you. Sure. David, what tips would you give a first-year law student, a Black law student, who is feeling really torn between just being able to focus on their education and yet with all of the racial issues that are swirling around, both nationally in Columbia and on MU campus, what tips would you give them for navigating that?
Well, that's a good question. I've actually had some students who asked me about feeling guilty when the events were happening in Ferguson that they were not there. that they elected not to go be a part of the protest, right? And they were feeling guilty and ashamed and embarrassed. If other people are there, I'm not there. What does that mean for me? They were questioning their own identities. And so I think part of it is recognizing, and what I sort of tell these students is, we all make these choices. And I said, even in the civil rights movement, right, there were folks who actually had to litigate. There were folks who were lawyers, right? Not everyone was on the front line. And so that's a personal decision, you know, in some respects. The other place for sort of navigating it, quite honestly, is I think sometimes you have to unplug from the things that are going on to protect your own psyche, to protect your own identity. The third thing is I think you have to find a supportive community. And sometimes a supportive community outside of the law school, right? Outside of the building where you go every single day. The last piece is, of course, you know, I, along with my other colleagues, you know, my other African-American professor and white allies, of course, try to be as supportive as possible, right? Try to be that voice, try to be that ear, try to be that support network. I mean, we've built up, I think, across campus, a good number of folks who are Black collectives and allies, groups and others, right, who can provide that kind of support. But it's that thing which I think is necessary. And like I tell my students all the time, I go, listen, I'm just as affected by these things as you are. I go, sometimes I go back to my office and it could be a gospel day or it could be a Tupac day, right? I mean, it really depends. It yes. really depends on what's just happened. So,
music is a great way, isn't it?
Yes.
Music, and I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. My best friend laughs about how I've often said that when you work in a majority white environment, or you're a student in a majority white school, sometimes all you can do is go to your car if you don't have an office and turn some music on.
Yes.
That's right.
Right. What are some tools, some tips that you express to students, Adrienne, in your school?
I mean, I just ditto everything that was just said with David. I mean, all of that. Yes. I mean, I share all of that with my students. That's the best advice. And so just to piggyback off of that, you know, just finding your power. And so when you find your power, you'll realize what you're able to do and what you're not able to do, and owning that. And so I've been working on that even with myself, finding my focus, finding what I can, what I'm capable of doing, what I'm not, and being okay with that. And finding time to dance, finding time to laugh, finding time to be a kid again, bring back that innocence, just selfishly unplug, like you said, and do things that make you smile, make you laugh. And for me, that's therapy to keep me going the next time it's time to go on the front lines or go back into the classroom. So unplugging is important.
Unplugging is very important. And both of you talk about community. I remember when I was in law school that Thurgood Marshall died.
Wow.
And it was interesting to see how people who normally didn't come together came together. I can still remember how we had a vigil of Black law students, folks who normally don't even talk to each other, mm-hmm. who came together because that was such a profound moment,
sure.
a profound mm-hmm. acknowledgement. And I wonder, how do students who were unconnected to one another find that space? I guess now there's Twitter, right? Twitter,
sure.
Social media. Mm-hmm. Do you think social media and Twitter help or make more difficult the road for Black students on MU's campus?
Well, I think it's a matter of choice, like we talked about, which was mentioned, choices. And once you find your power and your identity, it's all about how you choose to use tools like technology. I know for me, during the protest and things here on campus, I had to unplug from Facebook because I was being bombarded by so much negative energy. But now that I've been back on, I am being fed so many great things and connect with so many great communities. So I think it's just about how you use that power on social media, because it could be a great resource.
I think it's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it can certainly provide you with a supportive community. I think the other side of it is that because of the stuff that's happening nationally, because of the last 5 to 7 years of so many high-profile and tragic events, that becomes almost sort of paralytic, right? That you constantly see an image of an African-American male or woman being shot and killed. You constantly see this sort of this vitriolic rhetoric and response, right? And so it can be not just disarming, but it can be alarming to the point where you feel, you know what, I don't really want to walk into a classroom where I'm the only person who's like this. Mm-hmm. And so I think it becomes, so like I said, I think it can serve a very negative purpose in that regard. I think the other side of it, though, is that you can connect with people who are supportive, who will sort of say to you, you are worthy, you need to be here, we appreciate your voice, we want to hear your voice, and you're not crazy, right?
I mean, I think part of it
is
nice.
Is the self-check, right? Is that you think, well, wait a minute, somebody just said something to me. Is that me? Or is that really? And then you see, you put it out there, people go, no, no, you're right. That was really wrong what that person just said. And it sort of puts you into balance, because I think constantly we are questioning, you know, the whole notion of, are we hypersensitive?
Sure.
Are you too touchy? And I'm like, okay, it's not hypersensitive. You just offended me. And
well, you know, you raise one of the most principal points of all, I think, for being a student of color in a majority institution or a majority workforce, is that constant checking in with yourself and with other people. Now, you said it just exact. I always said that was the alternate title for my book, Working While Black. I wrote a nonfiction book called Working While Black, and I said the alternate title should be, Am I Crazy? Because that's so much of what you deal with. I mean, we probably all have had to call people or text people, whether
yes.
whether it's a you know, a spouse, a partner, a friend, to go, let me just tell you what did happen.
Exactly.
Or can I read this to you? Did this strike you as the same way it just struck me? And which leads to something else. Do you talk to your students, and you can just each tell me which, you know, to speak up. Do you talk to your students about the history of being Black on campus, the history of being Black as a college student, so that, similar to my play, they know that this isn't all new with Ferguson. This isn't all new with our latest election cycle of events. Do you think that history, it gives comfort, gives context?
I think it does give context. I certainly do. I let students know, you know, the protests that happened in 2015, they happened on my campus, my New England, you know, Northeast, mm-hmm. you know, Ivy League school campus. Not like it was all that different, you know, and that was 1987 to 91, right? Mm-hmm. Those were events that happened there. There were rumors of the KKK on our campus. I mean, it's not like this is sort of, it's just a different chapter for a different generation. I mean, that's fundamentally what it is. And so I tell them those stories. I also make a point when there were the incidents on campus, I think, when there was the students who put the cotton balls out in front of the Gaines Oldham Black Culture Center, or who wrote the N-word on the wall, and we hadn't found out who it was, and we were talking about it on the campus. I mean, I stood up in front of my class of students, and I said, quite honestly, what these events do is they make you all suspect, because I don't know who could have done this. And so as a problem, this creates a problem of our relationship, right? Mm-hmm. That there's someone who has basically attacked my identity, my race, and yet it's unknown. And I have no idea who did that, right? I have no idea who may support that. And this gets in the way of our relationship.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And with teaching a literacy course, I have the privilege of bringing up history and encouraging them to do the same. But we're reading a book in particular right now by Angie Thomas, The Hate U Give. And it is a realistic fiction, around a similar to the same topic of police brutality and things like that. And so, yeah, we're talking about the history so that students understand that this isn't something that just has come up all of a sudden, that students mm-hmm. decided to get mad one day and protest. No, this has happened. This is rooted in our history, way back from slavery, and then the narratives that have been told that leave out so many different perspectives and the power dynamics of race. So I'm kind of re-educating students who may be hearing this for the first time in my college course. So it's important to bring up.
This is Table for Three. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, talking with Dr. Adrian Clifton and Dean S. David Mitchell here at KBIA Studio. We're talking about what it's like on campus and in the classroom for Black students in Missouri. To learn more about this podcast and the Green Duck Lounge, go to greenduckproject.com. All right, so back to this great conversation here. So one of the things that I always find the most difficult in talking about not just being Black, but the specificity of racism in spaces where people just don't want to believe it exists. I remember in 2015 trying to explain to people the climate, the experience of being a Black student here. Because if I heard once, I heard 100 times from white MU graduates, well, I never saw racism. What are ways, tips, advice, input that we can have in getting allies to be better allies?
The important thing is to believe and validate and acknowledge other people's experiences. That's so important. It's not natural nor effective for, say, an abuser to tell the abused that I didn't hurt you, or you're not hurt, or that doesn't, you can't describe someone else's feelings or experiences. But the best thing an ally can do is acknowledge those, empathize, and then do whatever they can with their power to influence those around them. It's one thought around that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a couple thoughts on that, of course. It's no different than, I think, the current Me Too movement, right? Where we're asking people to believe experiences of women. Well, then why wouldn't you believe the experience of a student of color who says, I have faced this on a campus? Quite simply, it's the same thing, right? What I think is problematic, and certainly with those events that happened in 2015 and folks, alumni, feeling as though, oh, I can't believe this, I never experienced this. You know, I think that's the other conversation is, well, wait a minute. Why would these students put themselves out in this way, knowing the kind of response that they would be getting, right? And more importantly, they could have simply just left, but they didn't. And why didn't they? Why? Because they wanted to be invested. They were invested. They wanted to be MU Tigers, and they wanted the institution in which they were a part of and they were hopefully going to graduate from to be better, right? The simple thing would have been to just leave, and instead they didn't. They said, we are going to make this better for all of these students. To me, that should have been the narrative. That should have been, we should have embraced them to say, these are Tigers and they are important to us. We value their experiences and we are going to do better for them because it makes us better as an institution. And we sort of didn't. And even looking at when the football player stood up and struck, reading some of the comments on the Athletic page about just play, shut up and play, do this. How can you cheer for these young men on a Saturday and then deny them their racial identity Monday through, you know, Sunday through Friday? You can't have it both ways.
Right.
True. So let me ask you this. Do you see any difference in how the campus has changed and grown or regressed with the events of 2015? I know enrollment has been down, and there's some talk it's going back up, depending on who you talk to. Have you seen any response to that?
Sure. I mean, enrollment and the connection between enrollment and the protests, I think, is a little bit spurious, right? Enrollment was on its way down before those events happened. So folks have made that connection, and it's sort of like, well, no, we got to unpack all of that. There are a lot of variables. The number of Missouri high school graduates had been declining. I mean, there are a number of issues. But with that being said, I do think things have moved in a better direction. I think we are at least addressing some of these issues. The hiring of the system, you know, chief diversity officer, right? Having citizenship at Mizzou, right? The office being very proactive in learning and educating on the front end. We just received all, or we're actually reviewing the institutional excellence framework plans to address how folks are going to deal with diversity about recruitment and hiring and scholarship and access. And so we are doing the things now that I think we hadn't been doing for quite some time to actually improve where we're going. But it's a very slow process, right? Someone, I think I made a talk about this before. I said to someone, how do you turn a battleship very slowly? How do you turn a 175-year history very slowly, right? Yeah. It's not going to be any immediate sort of change.
But the turn is happening, and we're in the midst of it. And I feel it, and I see it in the College of Ed. I'm working closely alongside Dean Cheval. My whole position was actually created to fill a gap in the College of Ed. So I'm officially the community partnership liaison for the college, and my job is to really foster a bridge of our students in the community and foster that relationship. And so I can say that the College of Ed is leading many initiatives to help turn that ship around from curriculum to the messages that students are hearing? They're not going to hear diversity and inclusion and all the isms and privilege in one class. We're working on threading that through every course, regardless if it's math, special ed. And so I see it, even the bridge at the College of, in the College of Ed, that space where dialogues and workshops are fostered around diversity and inclusion. So I see it happening. Like I said, it's slow, but I am hopeful about where things are going.
Why is it, and how do we address it? Why is it that race is still this showstopper of an issue where when you bring up race, it just, there's so much energy, tension, resistance around it still?
Wow. You want to take that first?
I think it's because it's such an underdeveloped, unresolved issue. And I think that until we face the elephant in the room, if you will, it's going to be there. And so that's my first take, is because it's real, it's raw, and it's been so unresolved, and there's still powers at be that are trying to keep some of these systems in motion, and so there's that obvious tension.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at other nations that have dealt with their race problem, or their issue with respect to race, right? I was just in South Africa, so I think of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, right? Mm-hmm. We have never had that kind of hard-hitting, upfront looking at our past. We haven't said to ourselves we were wrong in what we did. Right. I mean, even if you just look at the period of time in which all the lynchings happened, we have never said we are sorry, we apologize. This was a problem. And so I think because we haven't done that, we haven't faced the honest truth that race has permeated the existence of our country and its evolution, and it is still present today. I mean, so I think that's one of the huge problems, that we haven't done that. The other piece is quite simply, it's very difficult if you say that you are the beneficiary of something that happened, that your ancestors got the benefits of, and that you are where you are because of people who were long before you. You feel kind of guilty saying, because it says fundamentally, yes, you didn't earn this all by yourself, right? That your place in the starting line is further ahead than mine because your ancestors owned mine. They built their wealth off of the backs of my ancestors. And so we're not at the same place. And there's some shame that goes along with that.
Right. Which I think is one of the reasons why dealing with these issues on a college campus is particularly challenging, because I think that people have a very false sense of the clock restarting once you come to college.
Yes.
So people have a tendency to go, well, whatever neighborhood you came from, whether it's a poor neighborhood in the inner city, whether it's a middle-class neighborhood, whether you're the fresh Prince of Bel-Air, when you come to college, you know, everybody's starting with a clean slate. But we all know that that's not the case. And I don't know how we address that on a college campus. Any ideas?
No, I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I'll sort of use myself as an example in that context. I had a very privileged educational background, right? I went to a private school, I went to an Ivy League undergrad and law school. And yet, I tell my students this all the time. When I walk out of the law school building, my degrees aren't on my forehead. I'm a black man in the United States in Missouri. And when I get in the car, I am still, more likely than not, I can be profiled and stopped. Those do nothing to shield me from race in America. And so this whole notion of the starting of the clock over again removes this notion of advantage, right? That mm-hmm. you had an educational advantage. You were able to take a prep course for you to have, you know, for you to pass your SATs, to have an advanced placement class, right? To move further along in your college credits, to have less debt. All of these things are part of that. How do you sort of get people to understand that? I mean, it's difficult to sort of get people, I think, to understand what privilege is.
Right. One of the backdrops for me being a student for 3 years at MU was Columbia. And that's the discussion that people often don't talk about when we're talking about MU, that MU is in a place that isn't always the most advanced on race relations. Is that still a case? Is Columbia? Are they part of the solution? Part of the problem? Part of the dance that Black students have to deal with in going to MU?
All of that. So yes to everything. Yes, they're a part of the issue, a part of the solution, though, as well. I'm a native of Columbia, and so I have to speak to my village of supporters in the community. And we are so rich in resources in Columbia. And the tricky thing about Columbia is that everyone is kind of doing their own thing. And so what my organization, Roy Street Roundtable, works to do is bring everyone together. Because at the end of the day, we're all in this together, right? And Columbia likes to build these positive narratives about themselves. So I'm working on, I'm helping our community bring some action to some of those issues. So Columbia is a part of the issue, but I believe that slowly this ship is turning in the direction of activism, of allyship, and of community members holding powers that be accountable. So I'm proud of what I'm seeing, but we got a long way to go.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think the whole town and gown, right, bridging that gap, right? I mean, that still exists. I think that we as an institution could be doing more to reach out to the community around us. I find it disheartening that students who live just a quarter of a mile away, this institution could be 3,000 miles away for their ability to access it. Do I think our young students of color engage with the community? Sure, right? Look, I had to find a barber. There's not one on campus, right? So, I mean, you have to go to the, I mean, there's very simple things, right, that makes you get out there. I mean, I teach a class at Douglas High School for a reason, right? Because of where it sits and who it serves. And so that becomes an important bond, important connection that I think we need to keep building further. And so I think the institution can do that, can do much better sort of in engaging in that way.
Every Black parent in America, when they send their kid off to college or send them off to another city, needs to do a tutorial on how to find a place to get your hair done.
Yes.
Because that is the number one thing that every Black person has to discover as like their first task. And you know, friends who are white will be like, what's the big deal finding duh, 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 duh. It's a big deal. You can go to any place and get your hair done or do it yourself, but if you have a perm or if you need a barber or you know your natural hair needs a little something, you got to even know where to buy your hair product,
right? But you know what it does give you though too, right? It gives you that community. I mean,
it
there's
does.
Nothing like
that's
sitting
true.
In the barbershop or the salon, right? I mean,
it's true.
That's where you get to hear wisdom and you get to talk to people.
That is true. That is you're right. That is probably one of the first ways you access the Black community when you move someplace else. Yeah. Sorry, I always find
That's true. Where you get your hair done or a place to worship, those are usually
right.
The two questions people ask,
that's
right?
Exactly. Well, this has been great. And Dr. Clifton, Dean Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us at Table for Three in the Green Duck Lounge today. The Green Duck Lounge is a play about Missouri civil rights history and current issues in activism. You can see the play at MU's Rheinsberger Theater, February 21st through 25th. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson, the playwright, and I'm hosting these conversations about issues of race and about the play as part of our conversation series, Table for Three. You can also join Adrienne Clifton and S. David Mitchell and me for more conversation at the production. Learn more at greenduckproject.com. See you at the Green Duck Lounge.